The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast Special Edition, May 30th, 2017. It's the Kushner cast. You couldn't go a long weekend without some big story breaking, but we actually mostly took the weekend off over here, despite the revelations about Jared Kushner. But now it's Tuesday, and I've got Carrie Cordero and Susan Hennessy in the Jungle Studio to discuss everything that's gone down since the Friday evening news break. Carrie, Susan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
All right, let's start with the factual background here. What do we know, and what are the facts that are in question, and how confident are we in what we know? Carrie, get us started.
Sure. Well, so there were two stories, and I think they approach the question of what happened slightly differently. The Washington Post story alleges that a communications channel was proposed by Jared Kushner, or at least discussed by him with Russian diplomats, to set up a secure communications channel. But that story does not attribute what the motivation for the supposed secure channel would be. It doesn't get into why the channel would need to exist or what it would entail. That was followed by, in close proximity, a New York Times article, which went a little further and which seems to confirm the same reporting or similar reporting that, again, there was this proposal to create a secure communications channel from the White House to Moscow that would enable direct communications to occur between the White House and the Kremlin. But the New York Times article seems to have more sources that are willing to say that the reason for the channel was to facilitate communications about specific security events like Syria deconfliction or other security events, and that the main purpose of it was to facilitate, in particular, communications for the to-be national security advisor Mike Flynn to communicate with Russia. So I think the two articles seem to agree that there was this proposal and that it was going to, it was at least being discussed that it was going to use Russian communications facilities. Where the articles seem to diverge, at least on my read, is what the purpose of the channel was.
Okay. Susan, do you have anything to add to that as a term in terms of the factual landscape that we're dealing with? And to your mind, before we get to evaluating any of it, what are the big factual open questions that as this piece of the story develops, we're kind of looking to understand better?
Yeah, so I think there are a few things that sort of fall in the category of
relevant facts to keep in mind that we already knew, but now have sort of newfound significance. So the first is that Jared Kushner met with Kislyak at Trump Tower. So actually, the White House did not acknowledge that until March. So after Michael Flynn had already been sort of forced to resign and sort of the story had blown up, they sort of quietly acknowledged that Kushner had met. So that is a White House acknowledged fact that at least this meeting, as described, appears to have occurred in the first instance. The other sort of storyline that is relevant here, of which we know lots of facts, although not a critical fact, and I'll get to why it's relevant to the story in a moment, and that is that we know that Michael Flynn had a series of phone calls with the Russian ambassador to the United States surrounding this decision to levy sanctions in retaliation for sanctions imposed regarding election interference. And we know that the White House mischaracterized the nature of those calls many, many times, and that sort of their hand was forced in terms of being more candid about that, essentially through a series of leaks, the ultimate leak being after Vice President Mike Pence had gone on national television to say they did not discuss sanctions, because it had sort of the specter was that somehow Flynn had made representations about lifting sanctions or other things as they came into office. Then it was revealed that there was a signals interception that showed that there was, in fact, sanctions were discussed. So that's sort of the parallel storyline. Whenever you think about what are the big open questions here, number one is the question of motivation. So we do have this sort of Syria explanation. It's a little bit thin, certainly plausible as one of the reasons why you might want to have this communication, although it certainly doesn't account for the manner in which they were setting it up. The other real question is, to what extent was Donald Trump involved in or directing this activity? That remains the really big open question about the Flynn calls. So we know that sanctions were discussed, but we actually don't know yet how they were discussed. Was there actually a representation that the Trump administration was going to lift sanctions? There's been reporting in the past 2 days in the New York Times that was an open question in the first weeks of the administration, sort of unilaterally lifting these sanctions. So we don't know what representations were made, and we don't know whether or not they were undertaken at the behest of Donald Trump. So now bringing in this story, which occurs earlier in time, I mean, it's like watching Memento or something, like the timing is all off here. Now that we know that there was this earlier meeting with Kislyak and Kushner, as well as Michael Flynn, the explanation that Flynn was freelancing here, that seems more unlikely because it seems particularly unlikely that Kushner was freelancing. So I think those are sort of the big open why were they doing this in the first instance? How involved was Donald Trump? And to what was their motivation in adopting methods that seemed to be designed to hide the communications from the U.S. intelligence community?
All right. So let's talk about those methods for a minute. Carrie, you were a longtime lawyer in the National Security Division at Justice, which, among other things, supervises counterintelligence investigations, prosecutes spies, and does other spooky stuff. I'm just interested in when you read a story, a news story, wearing that former hat, that reports, truth, rightly or wrongly, but let's assume for a minute that the Washington Post did not get this wildly wrong, that not only did they try to open a back channel with the Russians, but they tried to proposed doing it using Russians' communications equipment in diplomatic facilities. What alarm bells start ringing in your head when you read something like that?
Well, so it is I think the questions regarding the back channel really turn to who were they seeking to establish the back channel with, again, assuming these reports are correct, Who are they seeking to establish it with, which in this case is the Russian government? And two, how did they plan for the channel to take place? And according to these reports, it was proposed to be through a secure channel facilitated by the Russian government. That piece, from a counterintelligence standpoint, is what raises the alarm bells. The FISA statute, which I think in this context really can be looked to as something that we can look to help to understand how counterintelligence and how clandestine intelligence activities can be understood, because it's a statute that we can look to that's defined, talks about aiding and abetting others engaged in clandestine intelligence activities. Anyone who is in the intelligence business, who understands something about how counterintelligence works and understands how foreign intelligence collection works and knows something about Russian intelligence efforts, which now there's plenty of information publicly available, and certainly there would be information available to individuals on a transition team or in their later White House capacity, knows that the extent to which Russian intelligence operatives would use secure communications channels to communicate back to Moscow. So the idea that a American government official or an American political transition official who is about to serve in the White House would entertain the idea of using Russian facilities as the mode of communication is simply inconsistent with anything that anyone who has ever worked in the counterintelligence arena would understand to be a normal behavior. And so it really speaks to the how. And the second piece, the who, the fact that this wasn't some traditional ally, a friendly country, a country with which the United States has close partnerships in intelligence gathering. Not to say that there isn't some level of perhaps intelligence sharing or law enforcement cooperation that might occur between the U.S. government and the Russian government, but it certainly is very different than those sharing relationships that would exist between the United States and, for example, the Five Eyes countries or other European Union countries. The fact that it is Russia in particular, and if we look to how the U.S. intelligence community assesses Russia as it poses a national security threat to the United States in the cyber realm, in diplomatic realms, in military realms, really, I think, explains why myself and others with experience in the counterintelligence field, myself from the legal angle, have concerns and question the judgment of pursuing this path.
On a scale of 1 to 10, where would you, if you were at NSD and information came in over the transom that somebody had done this, and it was, say, as sketchy as the information that we've seen reported in these newspapers, is this a 2 on a concern scale of 1 to 10, a 5, a 7, a 9? What, like how loud are the alarm bells going off in your head when you read this?
Well, first, I will say from the former government perspective that folks in government, to the extent they might be listening, often take what they read in the papers with a really, really heavy dose of salt. So there is, one does distinguish from when you're in government from what you know to be true versus what you read in the papers. So I think I do have a fairly healthy skepticism of things like this that I read in the papers. Although the dual reporting of these two reports, I think, lends to their credibility as
and
well.
And the non-denial from the White House.
The silence from the White House, and also the credibility of the particular reporters, I think, factors into one's ability to look at these reports and find them credible, at least to some degree, to take them seriously. So there's that piece. But look, it raises a lot of concerns. I mean, the way it's very unusual from a national security lawyer's perspective to be thinking about these types of questions for individuals who work in the White House. I mean, it really is inconceivable. I started working in this area in government in the year 2000, and so and worked at DOJ till 2010. And so it's really inconceivable in our recent history to think about individuals working in the White House doing this. What one can sort of analogize it to is if this was a government official, some employee in the intelligence community who proposed to do the same action. So if there was some mid-level government employee who works in one of the intelligence agencies and who was exploring with a foreign government whose interests are often counter to our own, to be going in and out of their embassy, as one of the reports described, and using their own channels, that person would certainly be scrutinized from a counterintelligence standpoint.
What about you, Susan? When you read the story, you had quite the tweet storm this weekend about this. How loud were your alarms going off when you read this?
Yeah, so I think Carrie is being exceptionally responsible in how she's discussing it. I think the reality
be less responsible.
Of course, naturally. I always think of myself as a less responsible Carrie Cordero. To the extent that this occurred to somebody at NSA, they wouldn't just be scrutinized. I think they would be taken into custody. I mean, there would be very, very serious, immediate counteraction. And if they weren't taken into custody, it would be because there was a desire to not tip the United States government's hand that they were aware of this. Now, it's apples and oranges, right? It's not the same for somebody to sort of be freelancing versus what they're doing on behalf of the president or on behalf of the president-elect. That's why the question of whether or not this was being done on Trump's behalf or his behest becomes really important. I think it's worth sort of noting that, in the intelligence community, you have to get permission before you leave, before you go to a foreign country, and you have to report your visits to foreign countries. The intelligence community considers a foreign embassy a foreign country. So you have to ask permission, right? So every week in D.C., they have these like nice embassy weeks, and they open up, and you go and have hors d'oeuvres, and it's like
the famed Finnish sauna.
Exactly. It's a very sort of benign, fun cultural experience. In the intelligence community, you don't get to do that unless you've received permission to go to Finland and Russia and anywhere else. You have to get permission to do that. So that's because embassies in particular are historically very common places in which serious espionage activity has occurred. So I think that the question here is whether or not the desire to use the Russian embassy is just an example of really extreme naivete, and that certainly that's plausible on Kushner's part. It's less plausible for Flynn, although not entirely implausible. And the real evidence of how naive it is that the Russians refused to do it, right? Sort of even, think about how advantageous it would be to have transition officials come into the embassy in which they control their space and the electronic devices they have on them. I mean, right, this is a target-rich opportunity, one might say. And they're sort of freaked out by it, right? Like, what do you mean? No, of course you can't sort of touch our communications equipment. So I think that this is, it is a series of behavior that either demonstrates really, really astoundingly poor judgment among people who have access to our most important national security secrets, or if it's being done without Trump's knowledge and direction, then it starts to become far more nefarious and sort of suspicious, because what it looks like is really the only reason why you would want to use the Russian facilities is in order to hide from U.S. Intelligence or allied intelligence. That's the only right. The U.S. government can set up secure communications. They occur. It's ordinary for a transition to want to have communications. But those would have been done under, with ordinary ComSec monitoring and other sorts of, it might have been visible to allied nations. So this is the area in which even sort of the proffered explanation of, oh, well, you know, it was about Syria. Why would you need to hide that from the United States government? That's where, at least for me, I start to run out of benign explanations. And really, that's where the alarm bells come in.
Okay, so let's talk about a few factors that amp up the alarm bells a little higher, and then talk about some possible areas that might mitigate. So in the amplification department, it appears that this contact was not disclosed initially on Kushner's SF-86. And it fits in a pattern of non-disclosure of meetings with, on the part of more people than just Kushner, with this sort of Talleyrand on the Potomac, Sergei Kislyak. And so there's that aspect, right? That seems to make it a little worse. In addition, of course, it comes in the context of these Russian operations to, depending on how you want to characterize it, meddle with, interfere with, intervene with in the U.S. election. And these hot denials on the part of the Trump administration that there was any collusion. This has a little bit of the whiff of collusion after the fact, right? I mean, after you've intervened to in the election and we've denied it and claimed it was a 400-pound guy on a bed, we want to use your communications equipment to establish a secret line of communication. And so my question to you both is, does this look completely different absent those two factors, or is it integral to the alarm that you experience when you read it, that this is an undisclosed contact with Sergei Kislyak after these in a fashion that looks kind of collusive, after the election operation has already happened? You know, how much, if we change the circumstances and say it's the embassy of Lithuania after Hillary Clinton has won, one of her people goes in and it's a, you know, benign country and the contact is not denied or not, you know, not, and it's disclosed. How much of it is an inherent feature of the circumstance, and how much of the alarm is a, you know, just a creature of the weirdness of the overall ambience of this situation?
So on the point of disclosure, non-disclosure in a variety of areas is one of the Achilles heels of this administration, their unwillingness to disclose information. And I think particularly when it comes to the financial interests and the Trump family financial interests and the conflict of interest issue, that's where, because of their lack of disclosure and the whatever is the underlying information that they don't want revealed or they refuse to reveal regarding any existing, because I assume if they were non-existing, that would have been an easier question to answer a long time ago. But any existing financial interests or relationships with either the Russian government or Russian oligarchs or whoever it is, it colors how observers view any motivation for what they're doing. So, but for the one report that explains away the motivation for this potential secret communications channel to be intended to pertain to Syria or security interests, the difficulty with all of their non-disclosure is that observers tend to then look to what are the other motivations, and one place that our mind can go is the potential financial conflicts of interest. Because why else would one might think, why else would they need to have a communications channel that is knowable or hidden to the U.S. intelligence community or our allies. And the related point with respect to the intelligence community is that this is just one more episode that demonstrates the complete non-understanding of the role of the intelligence community that this administration seems to have. And perhaps there are areas where it has improved slightly. There was a report today that has a CIA director describing some improvements that have been made in the interactions with the president in his daily brief, in terms of the community being able to make that brief more understandable and more digestible in a way that the president wants to consume it, which is fine. But the role of the intelligence community over modern history is often to fill this back channel role. And the fact that the incoming, at least some two of the incoming White House officials, did not seem to understand that and actually were potentially taking steps to cut out U.S. intelligence.
Including one who'd run an intelligence agency.
Correct. Really just continues to demonstrate the difficulty in some of these White House officials or incoming officials in understanding what the role of the intelligence community is, what its role in American government is, and how the intelligence community is an institution of government. It is not just something to be bypassed.
Yeah, so I think sort of going to your weirdness question of like the Hillary-Lithuania example, let's take an even more benign. Let's make it the British embassy, and we find out that some of Barack Obama's people in the transition period had gone and proposed this secret communications channel. That would be weird, right? Like that would be, I think that would be something that would raise eyebrows as that's a strange, it's strange to want to like use other facilities. I think it is something that would, that people would ask for an explanation of.
Carrie's shaking her head.
Well, because there, and I'll make this point briefly because I think there has been information that former national security officials, you know, have revealed in public formats indicating sort of the very close relationship that U.S. intelligence services have with their British counterparts. So I think maybe from that perspective, the Lithuania example is a little more understandable.
Well,
General
Hayden specifically has said in public in his book that on 9/11, he called up the head of GCHQ and said, if anything ever happens to this building, you're in charge of U.S. intelligence. I do think there's presumably, I don't know whether he was using our communications channels or the British, or even whether they're different at that stage. But I wonder if Britain's a good example of
right,
your
so
point, Susan.
My point is that you would still, right, so it doesn't work because you wouldn't think that going through the Brits would necessarily evade U.S. surveillance. That said, I do think like asking to use another country's surveillance or communications equipment is still unusual. Sure. Even whenever there is shared space, shared secured spaces, those are undertaken separately. And I just think it would be maybe our minds wouldn't go to like a nefarious explanation, but I still think it would seem like a breach of protocol that was sort of searching for an explanation. In that case, it's there are other reasons why it's, you know, would be silly. But I think like it's important to note, like, this is not just about the Russian thing. It's also like this is a really weird way to act in general. Then I think you have to think about the context of where we are and the context sort of considering the offered explanations. So one is applicable to both, and that is sort of the role of the reason why we collect intelligence in the first place and the reason why we undertake foreign intelligence surveillance in the aggregate and sort of the critical nature of that broad situational awareness, the ability to know what is going on, who is doing what and why. That is something that really, really matters in terms of the United States' ability to keep ourselves safe, And to achieve our goals around the world, both diplomatically, militarily, and otherwise. And so I think it's important to have that in mind, right? Sort of the ability to sort of know what's going on in a neutral, non-political way, to have our decision makers be informed. And remember that, yes, he's the president-elect, but he's not the president. There is a president in that moment in time. Then take the two explanations. So one is that they're trying to have a back channel on Syria. So my initial reaction is, why in God's name would you be having a conversation with Russian government about Syria strategy in a way that appears to be designed to make it so that the Department of Defense doesn't know what those communications look like? Now, if there was going to be a back channel, and I'd sort of characterize this more as a covert channel rather than a back channel, it would be done in such a way that there would be the relevant actors within the United States government would have insight into it, even if it was not through the ordinary diplomatic channels. So whenever you put, and then you layer that on with the context of you have Donald Trump Jr. going to Paris to give a speech on Syria compensated at $50,000 to a Russian-backed sort of Kremlin-aligned think tank in October. That's weird that he would be paid to talk about Syria at all. It's weird that he would be accepting this money. Think about the moment in time that this is Secretary Mattis, December 1st, which is the day that this meeting purportedly occurred. That's the day that actually Donald Trump announced Secretary Mattis as the defense secretary. Was he involved in these discussions? Because if you were planning on having back channel discussions with Russia about Syria military strategy, you would think that that person would be involved. Then you go to sort of the third explanation, which is the sanctions one. You know, think about the context of after those sanctions were applied. There was bipartisan support. And from the Republican side, there was actually criticism of Barack Obama that they hadn't gone far enough. So whenever you look at this activity in that context and you realize that this is not just political gamesmanship. This is a group of people that have been elected that have an extremely strange course of conduct vis-a-vis the Russians, that are acting in a way that is bizarre, contrary to sort of the views and beliefs of a bipartisan consensus in Congress. And they're trying to do it in a way that's hidden. That becomes sort of the 12 alarm situation.
Okay, so let me try. Let's talk about some of the things that may mitigate this. The first is, you know, a lot of people, particularly conservatives, are saying, wait a minute, you know, opening up back channel with the Russians, and actually General McMaster said this on behalf of the administration, that, you know, opening, and General Kelly did too, opening lines of communication, you know, what could be wrong with that? So first question, why should we think of this as different from any other back channel of a sort that presidents or presidents-elect may sometimes set up? And second question, look, I mean, rightly or wrongly, and I think pretty evidently wrongly, the Trump and his people believed that he was being spied on, and that Trump Tower was being spied on, and that the campaign was being spied on. And so, you know, I have heard it said, including by some serious people like Mike Duran, that, hey, the most logical explanation for this is that this is a group of people who thought Susan Rice was spying on them. And so they wanted to open a line of communications with the Russians and not be spied on by their own government illegally. Leaving aside the paucity of evidence that espionage activity was in fact going on, is the belief that U.S. intelligence was watching them in a fashion that was not proper, is that mitigating as to the decision to use Russian communications equipment with respect to a back channel that you're setting up?
Well, like, I mean, I think that explanation only holds up if you forget the fact that they're going to assume office, 2 months later, right? So if that's the real reason, they're afraid of these people spying on them, then you don't have the communication until you enter office, right? And you control everything. So the fact that this is in the transition period and it's sort of being hidden is bizarre, because if you're doing something that you're not ashamed of and don't think needs to be hidden, then why is there a problem of anyone illegally listening to it, other than the non-related issues to the substance? And if it's something that the content of which you want to keep secret, why not just wait until the inauguration? It's just it structurally it looks far more like someone who is planning to have long-term communications that blind the rest of the United States government even when Trump is in office, and that explanation doesn't hold into that period.
Carrie, what do you think?
Well, my answer to your question would be no, because it's not
it doesn't mitigate it.
No, it doesn't mitigate it, because it's not okay to use as an explanation that an incoming presidential administration doesn't understand the law, doesn't understand how the intelligence community works, doesn't understand the rules about how surveillance would occur, and understand that argument that you just articulated that individuals in the transition might have had is just simply paranoid. That does not mitigate making a shift in behavior so out of the norm of what is sort of acceptable way of conducting government that it makes it okay. The notion that they were under some kind of mass surveillance by the intelligence community is simply paranoid. It's not based in law. It's not based in rules. It's not based on any kind of briefings that they requested and would have been entitled to request and receive to have a better understanding and be better informed. So I don't think that paranoia should be a excuse for legitimizing this behavior if, in fact, these reports are correct.
The other important data point is, that there are reports that they were warned, that people grew concerned about sort of the contacts with the Russians. And so there was a request for the CIA files by people on the Trump transition for other members of the transition in order to help them understand how careful they needed to be. So there was clearly even concerns within the Trump camp itself about something about the nature of these contacts.
Okay, I want to close, Carrie, with something I probably should have started with, which is some basic information for listeners about counterintelligence investigations and what they are and how they work. What is a counterintelligence investigation as distinct from a criminal investigation?
So a counterintelligence investigation, which is traditionally conducted by the FBI domestically, would be an investigation opened under Attorney General approved guidelines based on some facts that indicate a national security threat regarding an individual. If a counterintelligence investigation is conducted of U.S. persons or U.S. citizens here in the United States, that investigation would need to be predicated on facts. It would need to be conducted according to different guidelines that are internal to the FBI and that are guidelines that are approved by the Attorney General. There are time frames for investigations. Counterintelligence investigations are traditionally the most closely held investigations within the individuals who are handling them. So within the FBI or within the Justice Department, to the extent that there are lawyers assigned to work on those investigations in concert with the investigators, they're very closely held. And so the point that's relevant for purposes of sort of this broader Russian influence investigation, to the extent that it started as a counterintelligence investigation, is that counterintelligence investigations are usually not revealed publicly until there is such time as an indictment. And if there's not, the public never knows that those investigations ever took place. So the challenge in the current investigations that are going forward with respect to the Russian influence piece is that over the past several months, those investigations have begun to be revealed publicly. And so that presents many challenges to those investigations going forward, because these are not the types of investigations that that are effectively conducted in the public eye.
Okay, so a couple more very specific things about counterintelligence investigations. Purpose of a criminal investigation is to find out who did what and to prosecute them if they committed crimes. What is the purpose of a counterintelligence investigation?
The purpose of a counterintelligence investigation is to uncover intelligence activities that are being conducted by someone that, if it's a U.S. person, actually do potentially violate some criminal laws, like espionage laws or mishandling of classified information, but is to basically uncover the information that or the activity that the person is conducting. So let me give an example. If the individual is a U.S. person who is a person who has access to classified information and the investigation is focused on determining whether or not information has leaked to a foreign power, then the goal is to stop the activity. So one goal of a counterintelligence investigation is to disrupt whatever is the damaging activity that is harming national security, whether that is the leaking of classified information to a foreign power, whether that is the leaking of information to a public source, whether that is stealing information that is sensitive and selling it to some nefarious act or a foreign government or a criminal organization or something. It's to stop the activity, to uncover the activity, and then the outcome of that can depend on the facts of the case. So the outcome might be that the individual is prosecuted, or on the counterintelligence side, the outcome might be that the investigation is handled quietly and that person who was involved, who potentially has exposure to criminal liability, can potentially be used in some way to gather information about perhaps the foreign power that they were involved with, in which case the existence of the investigation would never become public and there would never be criminal prosecution. So I would say to summarize those, it is to uncover the activity, it is to disrupt and stop whatever is the activity that is engaged into, that is harming U.S. national security, and then the next stage is either prosecution or using that investigation in some way to further assist the intelligence community in its work.
A criminal investigation investigates either a crime that took place, a bomb goes off, you got to figure out who set it, right? Or a pattern of activity that comes to light that may be criminal and you investigate to find out whether it is. But you're investigating a crime, not a person, as a general matter. In a counterintelligence investigation, the matter under investigation is a person or entity. Is that correct? Like not a suspicious activity, but there's an open investigation of a person or entity. It's specific to that entity, right?
Well, a criminal investigation, you have a subject, you have individual person or organizational subjects that are the subject of that investigation too.
So right, but you could also have an event. For example, when a plane hit the World Trade Center, there was no immediate subject of that investigation.
Sure, there was the umbrella investigation of the 9/11 attack, and then there turned out to be individuals.
And then you develop
within that.
But a counterintelligence investigation does not. It starts with a reason to believe that meets the predication standards of the Attorney General's guidelines that a particular person or individual or entity is either working for a foreign power or being recruited by a foreign power. And the investigation is specific to that person or entity, right?
Well, today, and for some period of years now, actually, the Attorney General guidelines that govern FBI domestic operations, it's the same set of guidelines that governs criminal investigations and counterintelligence investigations and international terrorism investigations. It's the same set of guidelines. So it used to be historically, first when I first joined the Justice Department working in this area, that there were separate guidelines for criminal investigations and national security investigations and RICO investigations, and it was all separate. And now there is one umbrella set of guidelines. But to your point, sure, if there is a terrorist attack, for example, or an event, then that can launch a criminal investigation that then spawns off into different areas. A counterintelligence investigation is generally focused on there is a subject of that investigation. Although, again, with respect to sort of this broader Russian influence investigation, it does sound as if there are sort of multiple prongs of that, right? But an individual counterintelligence investigation is focused on an individual and has to be predicated by facts, and there's a whole set of rules by which that investigation needs to take place.
So the reason I'm asking you all these very leading questions is that in the last several days, we've had, starting about a week ago, a string of reports about Jared Kushner being under scrutiny by the FBI, and these reports have conspicuously not described him as a subject or a target or a witness, which is the language you would use for a criminal investigation. And my read on that is that's because what has actually happened here, very likely, is that the FBI has opened a counterintelligence investigation of Jared Kushner. And my question to you is, based on your knowledge of the way counterintelligence investigations work, how likely do you think I am to be right or wrong about that?
I am not going to speculate about whether or not he is the subject of a counterintelligence investigation. I will say that I was asked this question last week on MSNBC, whether, you know, what it means that he was identified publicly as a person of interest, a quote unquote person of interest. And what I said then and what I'll say now is that that person of interest phrase is not a, it's not a phrase that is used in counterintelligence investigations. It's just not. It's more of a public relations term that law enforcement, even the FBI, will use if they're looking for a fugitive or something like that. It's a very different type of use. So it's not a investigative term. Whether or not he is the subject of an investigation, it's hard to read through the reports. If he were and that were leaked, then perhaps we would be seeing the word subject in the public reporting, and we're not. So I am not yet willing to speculate about what the nature of the investigative look is at him based on what has been publicly reported yet.
We will leave it there. Carrie, Susan, thanks for joining us. You've been listening to a special edition of the Lawfare podcast, produced in cooperation with, the Brookings Institution. You need to do your part to help promote the Lawfare podcast. And by that, I mean you should be tweeting about the Lawfare podcast, sharing on Facebook the Lawfare podcast, and for God's sakes, reviewing the Lawfare podcast on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play, on all the podcast distribution services you've ever heard of. Do your part, and thanks for listening.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.